Well, you guys are all very quiet, so I feel like I should start, other than the popcorn. I am Tanya Wright from Michigan State University. I'm an associate professor of language and literacy there. Thank you for coming to a session that doesn't have the word assessment in the name of it, especially at this point in the day. When they asked me to talk about this topic, I said, "You mean you want me to talk about assessment for reading and writing?" And oops, the response I got was, "No, we really do want you to talk about how young children learn to read and write, because understanding that is so important for assessment, right? So we can't figure out what children do and don't know if we don't ourselves understand how children develop into literacy." So I probably will talk a little bit about assessment just because, that's the crowd. But I really am going to try to just do the fastest version I ever have of how children learn to read and write. And every time I tell people that I'm talking about this topic for, what, an hour and 20 minutes, I say it's my own personal version of hell, because I could do three courses. You know, we could spend forever on this. This is the topic that is what I study for my whole entire life. So it's hard to shrink it into a small amount of time, but I'm going to do my best to talk about just some of the important areas where we want to see kids' development, and how that may or may not apply to what we're going to be doing as far as assessment. Okay, so before we talk about how young children learn to read and write, let's think about what we have to do to read. Okay, as adults. So here's a passage that I'm going to ask you to read. I'll actually help because it's a little small. And then I'm going to have you turn to someone nearby you and talk for a little bit about what it took for you to be able to read this text. And when I say read, I always mean and comprehend and understand. There's absolutely no point in looking at a whole bunch of lines and squiggles and circles and not understanding what that's for. Okay, so when I'm saying think about what it takes to read it, I'm talking about what it takes to read and comprehend the text. Okay, so here we go. This is what it says. It says, for you, as an adult reader, okay? "We have seen in the previous chapter how the existence of an ordered-disordered duality structure allows the obtainment of a full quantum theory of topological excitations. In the present chapter, conversely, we will see how the same structure is at the very root of a method by which one can generate, out of bosonic fields, new composite fields with different statistics, either fermionic or generalized. In the first case, the method is usually called bosonization and allows a full description of fermions within the bosonic theory, whereas in the second, the method provides a complete description of anions, as the particles with generalized statistics have been called, also in the framework of the bosonic theory." Okay? All right, so turn to someone and discuss what it would take for you to be able to read and comprehend that passage. It's a little small back there. You can feel free to crowd up so you can see all those words. Okay, let's discuss. Okay, so what are some things? You can just shout them out, or you can wave at me and I'll point, whatever feels better to you, that you might need to know or be able to do in order to read and comprehend this text. Go ahead. Okay, so understand the vocabulary. Can you say a little bit more? Right, so there's some words that you don't really know what they mean. Okay, great. And so you can't understand. There are enough words in there that make it so it's pretty hard to understand the overall meaning. Great. Okay, so there's technical words that are clearly something to do with theoretical physics or something like that, right? Don't you guys watch The Big Bang Theory? You should know all this. Something like that. But there's also words that have specialized meaning for the, that are everyday words, but seem to have a specialized meaning for this particular subject area. So the example given was fields, right? We have a meaning for the word field, but that's probably what it, not what it means in new composite fields with different statistics. Okay, it means something else. What else do you have to be able to do? Okay, so even though you are a fluent reader, most of the time, when you got to some of these words that weren't in your vocabulary, you actually had to figure out how to sound them out or break them into parts in order to read them. Okay, go ahead. Yeah. Okay, so maybe some knowledge of root words or parts of words might help you to figure out what words mean, like in obtainment, right? If you know what obtain is, maybe it will help. Go ahead, back there. That's okay. Go ahead. Yes. No, I do see you. People in front are jumping in. Okay, so probably someone who was a physics major in college would do better than someone like me who was an anthropology major in understanding what all of this was about, because you would have built some knowledge and associated vocabulary probably for this text. Okay, what else? What about the part I did for you? What? Well, I did the decoding for you, right? I did a pretty fluent read-ish, because for something I don't really understand of this text, right? So I was able to look at the symbols on the page and figure out how they go together to make words pretty efficiently, and then to be able to say those sentences relatively fluently. Okay, so that's something. What else? What else did you need to be able to? Would you need? Maybe to read and comprehend this passage. Okay, some other texts might assist you, right? So maybe you could use some other texts to support your understanding, or the previous chapter, or even look some stuff up, right? Like the internet might help. Okay, so if I said you had to do this, what else? Go ahead. Yes, I was hoping someone would say that, right? Some motivation and fortitude to actually do this, right? If you're motivated to figure out what it meant, you'd be more likely to work through it than if you kind of take a look at this and you're like, I don't understand it. It doesn't mean anything to me. Why would I spend my time on this? And you decided not to, right? Which might feel familiar because especially for our young readers who are just learning how to decode text, it does feel hard. It is a hard task for them. So if you can, I give this to you to give you a hard task, right? Just to give you a little bit of what it might feel like for a kid who's just learning to read and write, and how hard this is. And sometimes when things are too hard or out of reach, we're not super motivated to do them. Or if we think we can't, right? Or if someone gives us the message that we can't. Okay. All right, so you all said a lot of things. And I'm going to talk about some, but not all of them today, but I think most of what you said I'm actually going to cover as we think about how young children learn to read and write. And I'm going to refer back to this experience as I go, just to give us all something we can all connect with. Before I move any further, just making sure that everyone in the room has heard about the Literacy Essentials. If you have not been to this website, please go to it, literacyessentials.org. These are documents with essential instructional practices for literacy at all sorts of different grade bands. So there's one for birth through five, there's one for pre-K, there's one for kindergarten through third grade, fourth and fifth, and then there are disciplinary literacy practices for 6-12. There are also literacy essential practices for literacy coaches, if that is your role, and there are literacy essential practices for administrators. They're called the school-wide essential practices. So if you haven't been on the website and checked out these documents, you really should. They are consensus documents where representatives from around Michigan, as well as researchers, including me, I was part of these conversations, came together and really thought through what are essential instructional practices that we would like to see in every classroom in Michigan, because this is what the research says will support our children's literacy development. So there are documents, and then there are associated videos and modules for to use for professional development. Okay. I say that because if you're in the front of, for example, the K-3 essential instructional practices document, because we're talking about early literacy development today, you'll see a long list, and I'll read it. I know at the back it's really small. For some reason, they've made the PowerPoint not take up the whole screen, and I don't know how to fix it. So I'll read it to you, but there's a long list of what it says here, literacy knowledge and skills developed in kindergarten through grade three that predict later literacy achievement. And these are areas where we have evidence that instruction can, in fact, support kids' literacy knowledge development. And so what you can see, the reason I'm putting the list up here is because I want to show you that it's a long list. There are more than five things on this list. Okay? I still go around the state and I hear that kids need to know only five things to become readers and writers. And those are the five areas from the National Reading Panel, which came out in the year 2000, right? Vocabulary, phonological awareness, phonics, fluency, and comprehension strategies were the five areas that were recommended by this panel. I want you to know that these were not the only five areas that kids need to develop in their literacy in. You can see that I've circled those five, and of course they're on the list. This was a list of five areas where there were enough research studies to do a meta-analysis and be able to show statistically that across many studies, these things helped kids. But the authors of that document would be the first to tell you that they did not put on, that those weren't the only five things. Those were five areas that they had the studies to do that type of analysis on. So this list includes many more than five things, and you all mentioned many more than five things just a moment ago. For example, you mentioned knowledge, and you mentioned motivation, right? You mentioned morphology, knowing word parts. None of those are the five things, okay? So I just want to start by clarifying that if we're telling our elementary school teachers that they only need to do five things to help kids learn to read and write, we're underestimating the task. Okay. Questions, concerns, debate? Am I saying something? Okay, you let me know. So here's kind of a simplified model. This is really simplified. I know it might not look simple, of reading development. Okay. And this is a model that comes from a text called McKenna and Stahl, Assessment of Reading Instruction. And this is from it's now got three editions. And what they do is they try to have a way that we can look at this long list in some sort of coherent structure. So we can think through what it will take for kids to learn to read. Okay, and this is just reading. I'll talk about writing a little bit later. And so the way that this model works, and I'm just going to point because we're a small group and you don't mind if I get up and move around, is what it's trying to argue is that there are several different areas of development, automatic word recognition, oral language, and strategic knowledge, okay? And there's kind of three strands, see each one, leading to each of these. And what it's saying is they develop in tandem for young children, right? So one doesn't precede the other. All of these develop together to support kids' reading comprehension, which is our ultimate goal. So the reason I like this model, if I'm going to have only an hour to talk about early literacy development, is one, it really says something very different to kids learn to read and then they read to learn, which is a phrase that we all like to say because it rhymes, but doesn't align at all with the research on literacy development, okay? What that phrase suggests is first kids need to decode, and then they can learn things by engaging with texts, right? But realistically, what we need is for kids to engage with texts, because adults are reading aloud to them, and learn lots of vocabulary and knowledge while they're learning to decode. They also need to learn a lot of information about how texts work, why we use them, some strategies, both for decoding and comprehension. And they need to be learning all of these things at the same time if our goal is for the children to be able to read with comprehension. Does that make sense? So it's not this one doesn't come before this one or before this one. They're all happening just because it's above, right? They're all happening at the same time in the early grades so that we can see kids see the type of reading comprehension we're hoping to see by the sort of middle elementary grades. Okay, so I'm going to talk you through this model box by box so we can all think about how these areas work together to support kids' reading comprehension. But I just want to keep in mind that even though I'm going to talk from top to bottom, we want them to happen at the same time in our classrooms. Okay? And when we're trying to figure out, for example, why a child may not be able to read and comprehend grade level text, we need to check all these areas. Okay? Because we do have kids who can automatically recognize the words and they sound like fluent readers, but they still cannot comprehend the text. And that's because something, they need support in one of these other strands. Okay. So the first box over here says print concepts. That's an area, skill, a domain that we usually see developing in the pre-K into kindergarten year. We really hope that by the time kids are at the end of kindergarten, they have mastered most of the early print concepts. And let me tell you a little bit about what that is. Okay. So when we think about print concepts, we think about print meaning. So this is the idea that print has a function, noticing print in the environment and how it works, so stop signs, signs on stores, right? The words on your cereal box. All of these things have meaning, and that what reading is when we look at those words, it tells us what it says, right? And it always says the same thing. If we come back tomorrow, as long as the sign hasn't changed, the meaning won't have changed. Okay, so that's an early understanding about how text works that if you start quizzing four-year-olds, some of them will know, some of them won't, right? And even once we're into our kindergarten classroom, some kids will have this understanding about how text works and some will not yet. And so that's something we need to teach. Some other information for concepts of print. We want kids to understand how page order works, how to turn the pages in a book. The title, the author, the top of the page, the direction we read print, so in English from left to right, and then we sweep back, and then we do the next line. So all of this is new information. I actually, at my morning talk, showed a video of a child who did not know all of this yet, and when asked, where do I start to read at the beginning of the book, said, I don't know. Okay, so this is really something that even though it seems sort of natural to us, that kids actually do need to learn. Kids need to learn about letters. What are letters? What are the names of letters? What does a letter do? The idea that it's a symbol that represents a sound. This is all very new for young children, and that we have upper and lower cases and case letters and we use them differently. What's a word? A word is a bunch of letters with spaces on either side. A word represents a word we say orally is represented by a word in print, right? There are shorter words. There are longer words. Letters make up words, being able to identify some words, right? These are all early skills. So if we look back at this area, if we have children who arrive in school in a typical class of kindergarten, there's going to be a range of knowledge in all of these areas. And so this is an area for kids' reading development that we need to support. Questions so far? Okay. So the other box over here, sorry, I'm going to go back, which is another early skill, is phonological awareness. Okay. And sometimes we focus on phonemic awareness, which is a particular type of phonological awareness. So phonological awareness is the idea that our oral language can be broken up into chunks, right? Smaller and smaller chunks. So we can chunk our oral language into words, which can be chunked into syllables, which can be chunked into sounds. The most important understanding that young children come to that we need to be able to read and write is this idea that words can be chunked into sounds, which we call phonemes. And this idea is called phonemic awareness, which is the ability to identify and manipulate individual sounds within words. So what does that look like? That looks like that a child, I could say k-at, and the child could say cat, but also I could say cat, and the child could say but also, and here's where it gets a little more tricky, a word like shine, which is actually spelled with five letters, only actually has three sounds in it. Sh, I, n. And each of those sounds is represented by letters. So sometimes a sound can be represented by two letters. This phonemic awareness is one of the five areas that was identified by the National Reading Panel, and it continues to be one of the most important early understandings for children. sometimes we're wondering why kids aren't making progress in their reading. We're wondering why their reading isn't developing as far as being able to sound out words. And it's often something to do with this underlying understanding of how oral language is broken down into sounds. And for us, this may seem like something sort of obvious, or we don't even think about it anymore. But for young children, it's sort of this fundamental understanding that underlies being able to read and write. We have to figure out how symbols relate to sounds, at least in English, right? Not all languages work that way, but that's how alphabetic languages work. Okay, so those are the earliest skills that we need to get to automatic word recognition. The next big set of skills or knowledge is letter sound knowledge, okay? And often we think of this as something that happens in kindergarten, maybe first grade, where children learn the names of the letters, the sound associated with those letters, and how the letters are shaped and formed. So this is something like A makes A, and it makes an A like an apple, right? But really, there's a lot more to learn about letter sound knowledge than just that. So what we're looking to happen, oftentimes late kindergarten, first grade, second grade, is that children learn more complex letter sound relationships, including digraphs. That's when two letters, the graph means letter, represent one sound. So that's SH makes SH or CH makes CH. But it's also vowel digraphs like EE together make the long E sound, okay? So when we see first graders and we are wanting them to decode words and texts and they don't quite know what to do, often case they don't yet have a lot of knowledge about digraphs, especially vowel digraphs, which are in most words. And sometimes they have misinformation about vowel digraphs. So they'll have information like when two vowels go a-walking, the first one does the talking. Well, that's incorrect more than half of the time, okay? So, for example, in the word O-O, in the O-O in book, it's not boke, it's book. The first one does not do the talking, okay? So so we have to do a lot of work with young children to learn that. Also blends, that's when two consonants are together, like bl in blue. Diphthongs, like the oi in oil, or the ow in out. Common spelling patterns like the A-K-E in cake or the O-U-L-D in could or would, right? And then patterns in multisyllabic words. You can see that what seems like a simple thing, there's actually a lot for kids to learn in the early grades of school to support them as readers, and especially to support them in moving from being able to read very simple texts to texts with multisyllabic words. And then someone already mentioned this one when we talked earlier, which is meaningful word parts, right? So are there parts like the tri and tricycle, triangle and tripod that we can learn that are spelled a certain way and actually not only give us information about how to read and write the word, but what it means? And so once we get into the third, fourth graders, we really want them to be working on this as well. So we can learn a lot about kids' letter sound knowledge by watching their attempts at reading, but also when we look at their writing. So here's a child, and the teacher's written below what the child is trying to spell, and you can see there H-I-P for ship, right? So that child does know that there are three sounds in ship and probably has seen the word before because they have some idea that there's an H in there, but they don't really know how to use two letters to represent the sh sound, right? And the same thing there in bright, you can see there's an attempt to represent the sounds, b, I, t, but doesn't yet know the letter sound relationships. Okay. Same thing over there, we can see lump is spelled like lamp, so short vowel sounds might still be something that that child needs to work on. So letter sound knowledge, just another area that we need young children to develop in the early years. Folks talk about sight word knowledge and that children should develop sight words in the early years. I prefer to call those lists that you might see high frequency words because they're high frequency in text. Okay. So typically we think of a sight word as any word that you can recognize automatically. And what we want is for young children to be able to recognize words they'll see frequently in texts automatically. But let's try it a second. Which of these words are sight words for you? Sight word means you can recognize it in one Mississippi. Which of these words can you recognize in one Mississippi? If I was like, go, read number F. Read item F. Could you do it in one Mississippi? How about item G? There's only one word that looks like supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. You probably have a really good guess, okay? So all of these words are sight words for most of us, okay? But they're not all high-frequency words in English. So what we ultimately want for kids is that all words are sight words, right? That means they're reading automatically, unless they get to a rare word that they maybe can't decode, like for us in the physics passage that we read at the beginning. Okay, there were some words there that we stumbled over because they're not very common and we don't necessarily recognize them automatically. We see in classrooms a lot of time spent flashcarding children to get them to memorize sight words, when in fact what we're wanting is for them to learn high frequency words. And the best way to learn high frequency words, because they're frequent in text, is probably not to flashcard kids, it's just to have kids read text, right? It's very hard to read text without the and you and a. So we probably could teach high-frequency words just like we teach most other words, right? Either as part as looking for spelling with the same spelling patterns or for reading as part of reading. These aren't particularly special words. They're just common words. And so we used to think we had to have kids memorize them before they could get reading, and the more recent research is suggesting that's something we could save time on and just have kids read more text. Okay. So if we're looking along, we're still over here. Just going to show you. We did phonologic awareness, print concepts. We did letter sound knowledge. We did high-frequency word recognition, and I want to talk to you a little bit about decoding strategies. Okay, so sometimes we think that if we teach the kids the letters and sounds, they'll just jump to being able to know what to do with those letters and sounds when they're trying to read a text. But it turns out that most kids actually need some strategies to support themselves when they get to a word that they don't know how to decode it automatically. So this is a list actually put together by some colleagues, Nell Duke, who many of you know, and Christine Schutz, who's in Chicago. And they put together a set of prompts or strategies that we want kids to know so that when they get to a word that they don't know automatically, they have something that they can try. And you might have tried many of these things with the physics passage, right? Look at the word is the first thing we say. Why do we say look at the word? Because when kids don't know what a word says, the first thing they do is look at the teacher, right? But you can't really figure out what a word says unless you actually look at it and the letters and sounds. Slide through each sound, so that would be like k-at in cat. Look for parts you know. Some of you mentioned that strategy in the physics passage. There might be a chunk of a word that you know what it is, and you can apply it. Maybe if you know tire, you could figure out squire, right? Try a different sound. Often kids just only try those short vowel sounds and they don't realize that they should maybe try something else. So they'll see the word rain and go rain, but they don't try the A sound for rain. Reread, sometimes that helps. Think about what would make sense. And last option is check the picture. And if you're walking around classrooms and that's the first option teachers are giving kids, we need to work on that a little bit because we don't read by pictures. We read by looking at the letters on the page and figuring out what the word says. If I just gave you a bunch of pictures and blanked out the text, not one of you could tell me that physics text. We actually have to read the words, right? So a picture is great to confirm that the word we read makes sense. So overall, when we think of what less skilled readers do in the early years, but in general compared to more skilled readers, we think of less skilled readers as relying heavily on context and guessing a lot, reading very slowly and with great effort, focusing on decoding rather than on comprehending, so just figuring out what those words mean, skipping challenging words and sections of the text, and not monitoring their reading to make sure it makes sense. When we think of sort of what a more skilled reader does, often reading a new word part by part, which is the strategy most of you told me. You didn't go sound by sound with those words. You could go part by part. Processing words automatically and rapidly, even words like supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, can get it pretty quickly. Look for known word parts in unfamiliar words, and use the context or the meaning to confirm, but not guess, the pronunciation. So all of these skills work together. Now our kids know how print works. They know that oral language is broken up into smaller sounds. They can represent those sounds with letters. They know what to do when they get to a word that they aren't quite sure what it says. they are starting to recognize more and more words automatically or by sight. Okay, that's when we start to see kids who are fluent readers. And when we talk about fluency, we're usually talking about three things. And these are not the three things measured by most fluency assessments, including the computer adaptive ones that many of us use, okay? Accuracy, automaticity, and prosody, okay? So accuracy is when we see the word, do we say it correctly? The correct word, we're not saying some other word or guessing something else. Automaticity is like a reasonable pace, right? Can recognize most words in one Mississippi. And prosody is that it sounds like we're reading kind of fluently. That's the best way for me to describe that. There's expression, right? There's reasonable volume, phrasing. All of that is prosody. And that's really important because we sometimes get kids who read, it sounds like robots, right? They are accurate and they are automatic. But the tone of voice that lets you know that they're actually understanding what it says is not there. And often that's because they're not understanding what it says. Like, I could do a read like that of the physics passage. I'm not totally sure what expression to have because it doesn't mean anything to me. And we really want to look for that as well. And particularly when we have kids who are timed over and over again reading the exact same passage and they start to think that fluent reading equals fast reading, that's when we see that missing expression. And that sometimes meaning is not the focus, right? Just doing it fast is the focus, in part because that's what they've been told good reading is. Okay. So when we think about fluent reading, there's something called the multidimensional scale, and it has a different idea than just a number or words correct per minute, but it says we're listening for things like expression and volume. Good expression and enthusiasm throughout the text, sounds like natural language, the reader's able to vary expression and volume to match interpretation of the passage. Phrasing is generally well phrased, mostly in clauses and sentence units with adequate attention to expression, so not word by word reading, chunks that make sense together. Smoothness, there's a general smooth reading with some breaks, but words and structure difficulties are resolved relatively quickly, usually through self-correction. So you make an error, doesn't make sense, you correct. So it's not that fluent reading is totally accurate, 100%. None of us do that, right? It's that when we do make an error, we realize, and it doesn't make sense, and we go back, especially if that error changes meaning. So when we think about fluency, we think about meaning-changing errors as telling us something very different from just a stumble on a word. Right? If I have a kid who's making a lot of meaning-changing errors, I'm saying this child is not comprehending the text because they're not noticing when it doesn't make sense. Okay. But if I'm seeing a kid who skips like the word the a few times, I'm not that worried. Okay. Because it hasn't really changed the meaning. They're probably just skimming over it like all of us do. And then we're looking at pace as being consistent and conversational. I share all of this with you because the assessments that we're going to do three times a year for fluency in our K-3 classrooms do not capture any of this, okay? Some of them do audio record the child, and the teacher can go back and listen for this, but the assessment is not going to tell you this. These aspects of the multidimensional scale have actually been shown to be very, very predictive of kids' comprehension. So it's something to think about. So if we're only using our correct words per minute scores, we're going to miss some important information. All right, here's a scenario for you to turn and discuss. A teacher has a second grade student who's below grade level for fluency. What other skills should we check? I'm going to give you a hint. Okay, turn around and maybe discuss for a little bit. So oftentimes what I see when I am in classrooms is we have a kid in second grade, and one of our three times a year assessments that some of us are calling benchmarks and some of us are calling screeners, we are all naming them also, some of us are calling computer adaptive assessments, we have lots of words for those things, but we're doing them, right? It's the law. And it comes back and it says low in fluency. So what do we know from that about the child? We know that the child is not meeting a threshold for correct words per minute. Okay. What we don't know is why. Right. We have no idea why, right? Was the passage like that physics passage for us where they had no idea what it meant and therefore couldn't read it fluently? Was there's some underlying or earlier skill or bit of knowledge that the child doesn't have. And the gut reaction to information like that is typically, they're not fluent. Let's work on fluency. Let's make them read the same passage over and over again to get faster and better. Okay? That seems to be what mostly is going on. Okay? But in reality, if the child, for example, doesn't have strong knowledge of letters and sounds, reading the same passage over and over again probably will make them faster at that passage, but it doesn't help them with the next passage where they don't have the letter and sound knowledge to apply to being able to decode the next text, right? Or if the child doesn't have any decoding strategies, they don't know what to do when they get to a word that they don't know what it says, and so they're just guessing by maybe the first sound, or they're just guessing by what makes sense because they're doing the best they can, because all kids are doing the best they can when we give them things like this, right? They're trying to do what they can with what they know, then they're not going to develop in their fluency, right? Because the underlying information, knowledge, skills that they're going to need, they don't yet have. So when I see a kid who comes back as lower than below grade level on fluency, who's a second grader, a third grader, first grader, any grade really, right? Could be an adult who wasn't fluent. I would want to know why. So has this student mastered all these component skills, but they're just a little slow and they need some practice? That really may be the case, and that is the case for some kids. But for many, many kids, especially our third graders that we're also focused on in our state right now, when we're seeing that they're not fluent, there's some information they don't have. Often, it's advanced letter sound knowledge, right? Like those chunks of words and what they say, so they don't know what to do when they get to multisyllabic words. Or some strategic knowledge for what to do or how to approach or attack unknown words, okay? So we're gonna check all of this other stuff, right? And hopefully the teacher follows up on that information, or the reading specialist, or whoever's doing that work in the building is going to take the information from the screener and try to figure out why, and that's the instruction the child is going to get. Because if we just give everyone the same instruction who shows up lower than expected on fluency, we're not going to see the progress we want, because we could have five different kids scoring a similar score for five different reasons. Does that make sense? Okay, so that's something that probably needs to shift quite a bit in how we're making use of the different kinds of assessment data that we're collecting, which is that often what we need is more information, right? Because that's what a screener is. It flags something that we need to know, so that we can go dig and get some more information. Okay, so here's one for you. A teacher shares that she's worried about one of her students. The student reads beautifully, the teacher explains, but I don't think she comprehends what she reads. What do we suggest to this teacher? Discuss, and then we'll take initial thoughts. Okay, so what could be going on here? What are your thoughts? What are you discussing? There's not really much of a, they can't really get a wrong answer. So you could just share your, I'm just asking what your thoughts are. Okay, so could it be that the child's rushing and isn't really taking time to think about the meaning, right, of the text? That could be one explanation. What else could be going on here? Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have this. Yes. Mm-hmm. So this is a common pattern, there are various terms in the literature for kids like this, but basically it's a child who can read fluently but is still not comprehending the text. And I bring up this scenario for a couple of reasons. The biggest one being that there's still an assumption, and it's assumed in our state law, just so you know, that if kids can decode fluently, they will understand the text. So when we say read by grade 3, there's some assumption that means that they're decoding fluently by grade 3, and therefore they're reading by grade 3. But our MSTEP is not a fluency assessment. It is a comprehension assessment. So we could have kids who are not doing well on this assessment, and it's not that they can't decode the text, right? They're doing really great on that top strand, but something else is going on that is making it challenging for the child to comprehend the text. And it's probably something here or here, okay? So the next strand I want to talk to you about is language comprehension. And that is, would the child understand it if you read it to them? Would they understand it in their oral language? Would they understand it if you discussed it with them or told it to them, okay? Let's think back to our example at the beginning. I did the decoding for you. Did you understand the text? No, I'm sure someone in this room did. I don't mean to underestimate the physics major among us. There's always someone. There's a ringer in the room. But for most of us, it's still a really challenging text to understand, okay? And often, that is something to do with we wouldn't understand it in our oral language. Perhaps because we don't have knowledge of the topic, we don't have vocabulary, there's something about the structure of it that isn't making sense to us. And actually there have been studies, some colleagues did a study in Washington where they did further investigation of the kids who weren't passing the state of Washington assessment, which at that time was at the end of fourth grade. And they found six different profiles of kids, right? So some of them were really smooth, fluent readers, but they maybe didn't know the vocabulary in the text, right? Some of them were disfluent, and they didn't know the vocabulary in the text. Some of them really couldn't decode the text at all, right? So there were, you know, if you put those in all those permutations, only a very small percentage of the students actually had a learning disability. So I share all of that because we don't want to conflate reading with fluent decoding, because it's not, or at least we don't want to conflate reading comprehension with fluent decoding. It's really not the same thing. And so I want to talk about this middle strand, which is, would they understand it in their oral language? Would they understand it if you read it to them, and what do they need for that? So they definitely need vocabulary and knowledge. And these actually relate to one another, but are not the same thing. And I like to use the example of an iceberg for this relationship. So sometimes we can know a word, right? Like I can say the word photosynthesis, and I can know something about what it means. It's something to do with plants. But I don't necessarily have fully developed conceptual knowledge of what that process is or how it works, right? Similarly, I can have some conceptual understanding of something and how it works, but I don't know the word for it yet, right? So we can have knowledge without the correct terminology. We can have words in our vocabulary, but we don't fully know what they mean. Another great example is we all have the word field from the text at the beginning. We know what a field is. If it's, if we're driving to Ann Arbor from somewhere else in Michigan, we probably pass a bunch of them, but we don't know what a bosonic field is, okay? Okay, so here's an example. I did the word precipitation, right? So a child is reading a book about weather and climate, and one child knows that maybe knows precipitation has something to do with rain, and another person comes to that same text with a lot more knowledge associated with that word, right? Like that precipitation is water released from the clouds. It comes in different forms. We get all of them in Michigan, like freezing rain and sleet and snow and hail and fog and drizzle. Something about the water cycle, evaporation, condensation, water vapor, maybe some ways of measuring precipitation, other meanings like sudden haste, which you all learned in chemistry class at some point, and the creation of a solid from a solution, right? So we could bring a rich a knowledge associated with a word to understanding a text, or we could have very limited knowledge of that word, which might limit our understanding of the text. So I could probably give you a dictionary definition of boson. It's not going to help you enough unless you have a rich knowledge of physics to contextualize that in. So vocabulary and knowledge are both important for understanding text, but they're not the same thing. But they're both. I wanted to give you an example of how important knowledge is for understanding a text, even if in our oral language. Okay, so there's a study. It's kind of a classic study in literacy research by Recht and Leslie. It's and what they did is they had a bunch of kids, and some of them knew a lot about baseball, and some of the kids knew nothing at all about baseball, and some of the kids were poor readers, that's their term. It's an older study. And some of the kids were good readers, okay? So we had good readers with high knowledge of baseball and good readers with low knowledge of baseball. We had poor readers with high knowledge of baseball and poor readers with low knowledge of baseball. And everybody read a text about baseball, okay? So you won't be surprised to know that the kids who were good readers and had a lot of knowledge about baseball were the best at comprehending the text, okay? That tells us we want kids to have great literacy skills and a lot of knowledge. But it turns out that the next best group of kids, we would guess, I mean, my guess would be, if I hadn't read the study, that the good readers were the next group, even if they didn't know a ton about baseball. But that, in fact, was not the next group. The next group were the high knowledge kids, even though they had more difficulty as readers. So they would be able to use their knowledge of the topic to compensate for their reading skills in order to comprehend the text. So that's how big of a role knowledge can play for kids comprehending text. And when we think about our assessments, it's really important to understand that might make a big difference to how kids are scoring on a reading comprehension passage. I have an example that I like to do from my daughter. She took her NWEA MAP assessment and came home and told me that there was a passage she had no idea what it was, and I could expect for her to have done very poorly on the test. And I said, well, do you know even a little bit about what it was about? And she told me, knights and squirrs. And she told me, I don't know what a squirr is, and I didn't know what it was all about. Okay, so my third grader did not know a ton about medieval times, knights and squires. In my head, I'm also saying, oh, she also needs some letter sound knowledge, okay, strand one. But also, knowledge made a big difference. She knows nothing about the topic. She doesn't know the associated vocabulary. That's going to make it hard to comprehend that text. So knowledge, very important. How do we build knowledge in schools? Well, we make opportunities for things like, you know, science, social studies, reading a whole bunch of texts on a topic that we're interested in so that we can learn something deep about that topic and bring that to the next text. All the things we don't always make time for in our elementary classrooms because we're so focused on literacy. Okay, just my point is, if we could help kids a lot in their literacy by having opportunities for them to develop knowledge to bring with them to comprehending texts, okay? And then, of course, vocabulary. And you all mentioned the vocabulary comprehension relationship. And I always share either a gate or a hurdle. You can pick your metaphor, okay? But really, if there are a bunch of words that we don't know the meaning of it in a text, whether we are a child just learning to read or an adult reading about physics, theoretical physics, we cannot understand the meaning of that text. So maybe if there's one challenging word, we can kind of get by, lose a little bit of meaning, especially if that word is not in an important concept in the text, right? It's kind of extraneous, maybe two. But at some point, there are too many words we don't know what they mean. We cannot understand the text. And there have been plenty of studies showing this, and also studies on the other end, that if we help kids know the meaning of the words in a text by explaining the word meanings to them, they become better at comprehending the text. So again, building kids' vocabulary, building kids' knowledge, these are really critical. And I would argue, rarely things we support very well in the early grades of school. And then we say, why are only 50% of our kids not doing well on MSTEP? Well, it's not necessarily that they are not able to decode fluently. Okay. I could do days and days on vocabulary and knowledge, but I'm going to stop there. You all had the experience of it at the beginning of this time. Okay, so the last strand, so hopefully, again, as we're supporting kids' fluency, we're also engaging them in lots of learning experiences to build their vocabulary and knowledge, and it all comes together because they understand it in their oral language, and they can decode fluently, and they can comprehend the text. But what about when they get to something that they don't understand in the text? They do know what the words mean, but it's still a little confusing, or when they get to a new type of text that's doing something a little different, that's where this third strand comes in, okay? It's purposes for reading, specific purposes for reading a particular text, and then knowledge of strategies for reading. And strategies are what we do to help ourselves when something as a reader is not going well. So comprehension strategies help us when our comprehension is breaking down. We have some things to try. Decoding strategies, I showed you a whole list of them. When I get to a word I don't know, there are vocabulary strategies. What do I do when I get to a word and I don't know the meaning? Are there some things I can try, like use the context or look at meaningful word parts or consult an adult? All of these are reasonable strategies that could help, right, to help as a reader. Okay. So the third part of the strand that we want to be developing all at the same time to get us these amazing reading comprehender kids is strategic knowledge. So we're helping kids to learn to be strategic, to know what to do when they get stuck. This is a little hard to read. Again, it's kind of small. But there are actually things, people always say, well, how do you assess strategic knowledge? Well, there are actually interviews we can do where we ask kids what they know as readers, and they tell us, and they are incredibly revealing. So we say things to kids like, what makes someone a good reader? And when they say stuff like they read really fast, or the teacher gives them a good grade, or they can sound out all the words, then we know something about what they understand about purposes for reading, right? Those are very school-oriented purposes for reading. That's really different to a kid who says they really they can understand the books, they like reading Harry Potter, right? My friend is a really good reader. He reads all the books in the whole classroom about dinosaurs, okay? That's telling you that kid knows something different about reading. Or here's another one. Should a person read everything at the same speed? Okay. So we have kids who say, yes, you have to read everything very fast. How do you know? My teacher tells me. Okay. And then we have other kids who say, no, it's okay to slow down when you don't understand. You really should slow down and read a little slower and think about what you're reading. Or if something's hard, you can read it a little bit slower. Right? So those kids know some strategies to support their reading. Another favorite one I have is, what do you do when something doesn't make sense when you're reading? Or when you're reading something for class, how do you know when you're done? What do you think kids say? What? Okay, that would be nice. But how do you know when you're done reading in class? When my teacher tells me. Yeah, right? How do you know when you're done reading it? When my teacher tells me. Okay, so that's going to tell you something about what that child understands about reading and what reading is for and why reading is important compared to a child who says, when I'm done, or when I understand it, or when I feel like I know what it's about, or when I don't like it, you know, I stop reading it. Those are all much what most adults might say, right? But a common answer, especially for kids who have difficulties as readers, is when my teacher tells me I'm done or when reading time is over. Okay. And, you know, things like, what do you think about when you're reading a book with lots of information compared to a story, right? So all of that helps us understand, just talking to kids, asking them these kinds of questions, what they understand about the purposes for reading, also about what strategies that they're trying as readers. Okay. I promised. So, just so we've looked at all of this, right? So, if we're looking at this that I told you, it is a very oversimplified model, because if I was going to really hang around with you for a long enough time and we were going to read some articles on all of this, we'd realize that the arrows don't always go that way. Sometimes things like letter sound knowledge can also help your phonological awareness. As you become more fluent, you can learn more, you know, you become better at print concepts about things like punctuation, right? You know what a semicolon is. So even though you're older, now you're still talking about print concepts, right? So all of these things kind of work together. Vocabulary background knowledge, we talked about those working together. Reading comprehension can actually support your vocabulary. Lots of things like that, right? So this is a much oversimplified model, but it's a good model for just saying how much goes into what we're shooting for when we say we want our kids reading by third grade. Because that's a lot of stuff I just talked about. And this is only the stuff that goes on in the kid's head. We're not really talking about the task we're giving kids. Is it an assessment task? Is it a fun task? Why are they reading? And we're not talking about other factors about the reader. Are they motivated? Are they interested in the topic, right? Or other factors in the text, right? Is this a text? Is this a particular type of text that they need to learn to read? So there's a lot more even beyond this model. That's why this is a cognitive model. It's like the things the kid has to be able to know and do in their head. The context, right? How is reading in the classroom? What's the culture around reading in the classroom, or beyond the classroom? What are the messages we're telling kids about themselves as a reader, right? So there's even more than all of this that goes into what we're hoping for kids. Okay, just briefly, because it's almost time to go. I told you it would be hard for me to keep all of this to this amount of time. What about writing? Okay. Well, we could have a similar giant model for writing, but I'm going to talk just about a few of the things we need for kids to know and be able to do to become writers. Okay. Handwriting and word processing. They need to be able to actually form the letters or type the letters or somehow make the letters get onto a page or a screen or wherever they're writing. Okay, so that's something kids need to be able to do. And there's some evidence that learning to form the letters, I'm not talking about which font, not a cursive versus not debate. Like, I'm just talking about the practice of forming the letters actually helps kids learn their letters in the early grades, because it's a kind of multi-sensory way of knowing, okay? How to compose text, things like how to plan, draft, revise, edit, and some strategies for taking yourself through all of those parts. Different types of texts, the structure of different kinds of texts, different text genres, the different craft aspects of writing, spelling. We talked about letter sound knowledge for reading, but you also need to know it to write words. How to construct a sentence, including things like capitalization, punctuation, right? So there's a ton for kids to know, a motivation, and all the things we've already talked about for writing as well. So here's just some cute kid writing, because I'm overwhelmed. I'm making you drink from a fire hose here. So this one says, when my sisters were born, I was excited. I-C-S-U-D-I. But that's what writing looks like in the early grades of school. And I love the sister's umbilical cord. still there, the little, okay. But just for any of you who have watched a kindergartner or first grader try to do this, this is really hard work for them, right? To figure out the sounds in the words, to pick out the letters, to actually physically make the letters, to remember words that they might already know how to write, like the word my, and then to try to write words that might have a lot of letters in them, like excited, the best that they can. Okay. And I just wanted to say, don't forget motivation and what a big factor motivation is in all of this, right? So these tasks, if we're just handing a lot of worksheets to kids to learn these skills, might not feel super duper motivating compared to if they feel meaningful and important to kids. Especially in the early grades when reading and writing are kind of painstaking, right? It's a lot of hard work. If you remember any new skill that you've tried to learn recently, I tried to learn guitar and sailing in the last few years and failed miserably because I didn't like the feeling of being so bad at it. That's how kids feel, right? It's super hard. So motivation makes a big difference, and believe it or not, there are things we can do to assess kids' motivation. So, for example, this is called the Elementary Reading Attitude Survey, and it asks kids things like, how do you feel when you read a book in school during free time? And some kids are like, I don't. And I always laugh at this one because it's Garfield, and Garfield's never really happy. So even the happy Garfield is just, no. But it's an older survey, you can guess, designed in the 80s, which is why Garfield is on there. But you could do emoji smiley faces and accomplish the same thing. But kids will tell you. How would you feel if you got a book for a present? Okay, so that was a lot. It really does matter. Why does it matter that we understand kids' literacy development, especially in the early years? Well, for one thing, if we want them to be able to do what we're saying, right, which is be good at reading comprehension at grade level for grade level texts, by the time we get to third grade, we need to understand everything that goes into kids being able to read and write so that these are all supported in our classroom. And we sort of need to understand that when those, when the assessments we're doing three times a year come back and they give us some information, what else do we need to dig into in order to know what instruction to provide for kids? We have to do this. We have to do this better for our kids in Michigan. Because we've all seen our state data, and we, even though we're excited because we score better compared to other states this year, we're still not where we want our kids to be, okay? What I want you to take from today is not all the nitty-gritty details. It's that teaching literacy to all kids is more complicated than it may seem, and there's no magic bullet or one way for kids. You can imagine that at any of those boxes on that model, that could be challenging for some children and not challenging for others. So we have a class of 25 kids in front of us, and they're all in different places in those boxes on the model, and we have to know where they are and what they do understand so that we can figure out what to teach them next to move them towards our goal, which is strong reading comprehenders. There are assessments that we can do, that teachers can do associated with each of these areas, and I talked about some of them this morning, but in the classroom, and then there are also more formal assessments we can do at the end of the year or at certain time periods to figure out where kids are in these skills. But I think what's most important is that we take the information and it informs our instruction. Because if we can't figure out where each kid is in their literacy development and what they do and don't know, we're not going to be able to move them along, and that's what we want. We want every kid making progress in their literacy development. And we cannot expect that everybody is in the same place. There's just too much going on, right? So that's what I have for today, and I left a little bit of time for questions. Yes. Don't remember scenario one, but yes, tell me. Right. So I think, and you're going to come up to me afterwards, so I have an article for you to read. So more and more, the research would say, you can sound out said. It's represented by the S, eh, represented by the AI, and D, represented by the D. So two of the sounds are actually perfectly sound outable. It's that the AI makes an unusual sound compared to what AI makes in other words, like rain, right, or pain. So... Right. So a student who is doing that needs to learn that sometimes two letters work together, right? Vowel digraphs. Two letters work together to make a vowel, a sound. And this is kind of an unusual sound that A and I make together, not the more common one. But so more and more of the evidence is suggesting that even for words where the letter-sound relationships are more uncommon, we do want to still acknowledge that there are letter-sound relationships, and we want kids to see the more common patterns, and then also know that there are more rare or uncommon patterns. Like should, but should is the same as could and would, right? So we want kids to learn by analogy, right? If I know should, I also know would and could, right? When I look at he and she and the, they all have an E at the end. But he and she, the E makes the E sound, but in the, it makes the sound, right? But the other two letters, the TH makes the V, which is a common sound for TH, and V. And in she, the SH makes sh, which is a common sound, and he, the H makes h, which is a common sound. So we do want to help kids, just because the research more and more on how our brains process words is that we do have those letter sound relationship understandings, even when it's a less common one. So we definitely want them to know how to read the. They're going to learn how to read the because it's in text a lot. But we also want them to think about, okay, when there's consonants and then an E at the end, sometimes like in the, it makes a. Sometimes like in he, she, we, it makes E. And doing that kind of analysis is really supportive of kids being able to sort of sound new words out by analogy, which is what we all do, right? So if we go back to the original passage... The way that I know how to sound out, let me do a really good one that is a new word, fermionic, right, is I'm not going f, e, r, m, right? I know other words that end in ick. I know E-I-O-N is either shin or eon, right? It's going to be one of them. Don't know this ER usually makes or air, you know, it makes that sound because it's an R-controlled vowel. So those things I'm just processing because I know how it is in so many other words. Okay. I could do an entire PowerPoint on sounds, teaching kids to spell by analogy and why we should do that rather than memorizing individual words, but we'll have to come back for another day on that. It's literacy essential number 5 if you're looking at the K-3 essentials. Other questions? Yes.
I'm thinking and reflecting on my own reading and realizing that I'm, for the first time in my life, having a problem with fluency, and it's because I don't see well anymore. And so I'm just wondering how often kids' reading problems
are visual.
Because of vision.
So I want to slow down that question a little bit, because we used to think that people used to think that dyslexia was a seeing issue, like kids saw the word letters backwards, and we know that that is not, in fact, not the case, right? It's actually a phonemic phonological awareness and phonological processing difficulty for kids, and so they don't map the symbol to the sound as consistently, and so they tend to make errors. So all kids flip letters at the beginning of school because they don't know how symbols work, because chair, but P, you flip that around, it looks like a D, Q, right? So the idea that symbols have to face a certain way is new for kids. All kids make errors. It's not a visual issue. I just want to eliminate that. That said, if we can't see the letters on the page, we cannot read, right? The letters on the page. So of course, right, if a child has vision difficulties, that would make a difference. But that would make a difference beyond just text, right? So whatever vision difficulties would also be the same with small pictures. I mean, if it was small or if it was far away, like seeing the board, you wouldn't be able to see other things like animals or a bird in a tree, right? Or I always say when I get new glasses, the leaves look clearer on a tree for me. I'm like, ooh, the trees have leaves. It just looked like green blur before. So we just have to separate that out. So of course, if you can't see, it's going to be an issue for reading. But not being able to see is not the same as a reading disability. Okay. So yeah. And hopefully, in addition to our literacy screeners, we are doing vision screeners in our school, and trying to pick up on kids for whom that would be an issue. And it can make a huge difference. Other questions broadly about early literacy development? Okay, well, maybe NWEA put more snacks out for us. They're feeding Michigan.
Yeah.
thanks for coming today. I know I'm probably way more excited about all of this than all of you, especially at the end of the day, but hopefully you can get a little excited.
Thank you.
Bye.